Hello everyone and welcome back to Bee's Corner, a true crime podcast where I dive into the most infamous true crime cases of all times. I've been gone for a really long time because of school, to be honest. I'm an international vocal arts student and I'm also studying and preparing for other exams as well. And you know, this year has just been hell. And I couldn't just really find the time to, you know, research and prepare for an episode for a really long time. But now that I have finally got the time to do it, I decided to give you guys this episode. So as you guys have seen from the title, this episode is about the Black Dahlia murder. Everyone knows about the Black Dahlia murder, and this was like one of the very first true crime cases that really got me interested in true crime, like especially after watching American Horror Story, and I was just really interested in it, and I decided to dedicate this episode on the Black Dahlia murder. So pretty much on the morning of January 15, 1947, a mother taking her child for a walk in a Los Angeles neighborhood stumbled upon a gruesome sight: the body of a young naked woman sliced clean in half at the waist. The body was just a few feet from the sidewalk and posed in such a way that the mother reportedly thought it was a mannequin at first glance. Despite the extensive mutilation and cuts on the body, there wasn't a drop of blood at the scene, indicating that the young woman had been killed elsewhere. The ensuing investigation was led by the LA Police Department. The FBI was asked to help and it quickly identified the body after getting blurred fingerprints from Los Angeles. The young woman turned out to be a 22-year-old Hollywood hopeful named Elizabeth Short, later dubbed the Black Dahlia by the press for her rumored penchant for sheer black clothes and for the Blue Dahlia movie out at that time. Short's prints actually appeared twice in the FBI's massive collection. First, because she had applied for a job as a clerk at the commissary of the Army's Camp Cook in California in January 1943. Second, because she had been arrested by the Santa Barbara police for underage drinking 7 months later. The Bureau also had her mugshot in its files and provided it to the press. In support of LA police, the FBI ran record checks on potential suspects and conducted interviews across the nation. Based on an early suspicion that the murderer may have had skills in dissection because the body was so cleanly cut, agents were also asked to check out a group of students at the University of Southern California Medical School. And in a tantalizing potential break in the case, the Bureau searched for a match to fingerprints found on an anonymous letter that may have been sent to authorities by the killer, but the prints weren't in FBI files. Who killed the Black Dahlia and why? Well, it's a mystery. The murderer has never been found, and given how much time has passed, probably never will be. So the legend thus grows. That was pretty much an overview of the Black Dahlia case. So I first wanted to start with Elizabeth Short's life, and then move on to what really happened and who are the potential suspects. So Elizabeth Short was born on July 29, 1924 in Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Shortly after she was born, her parents moved the family to Medford, Massachusetts. Again, Claire Short, Elizabeth's father, was making a living designing and building miniature golf courses. When the Great Depression hit in 1929, he abandoned his wife, Phoebe Short, and his five daughters. Cleo proceeded to fake his suicide, leaving his empty car near a bridge, leading authorities to believe he had jumped into the river below. Phoebe was left to deal with the hard times of the Depression and had to raise the five girls on her own. To support her family, Phoebe worked multiple jobs, but most of the Short family's money came from public assistance. One day, Phoebe received a letter from Cleo, who had moved to California. He apologized and told Phoebe that he wanted to come home to her. However, she refused to see him again. Elizabeth, known as Betty or Beth, grew up to be a very beautiful girl. She was always told that she looked older and acted more mature than she really was. Although Elizabeth had asthma and lung problems, her friends still considered her to be very lively. Elizabeth was fixated on movies, which were the Short family's main source of affordable entertainment. The theater allowed her an escape from the dearness of ordinary life. When Elizabeth was older, Cleo offered her residency with him in California until she was able to find a job. Elizabeth had worked in restaurants and theaters in the past, but she knew she wanted to be a star if she moved to California. Driven by her enthusiasm for the movies, Elizabeth packed her things and headed to live with Cleo in Vallejo, California in early 1943. It did not take much time before the relationship became strained. Her father would scold her for her laziness, poor housekeeping, and dating habits. He eventually kicked Elizabeth out in mid-1943, and she was forced to fend for herself. Elizabeth applied for a job as a cashier at the post exchange at Camp Cook. The serviceman quickly noticed her, and she won the title of Camp Cutie of Camp Cook in a beauty contest. However, Elizabeth was very emotionally vulnerable and desperate for a permanent relationship sealed in a marriage. Word spread that Elizabeth was not an, quote, easy girl, which kept her at home instead of on dates most nights. She became uncomfortable at Camp Cook and left to stay with a girlfriend who lived near Santa Barbara. Elizabeth had her only run-in with the law during this time. On September 23rd, 1943, she had been out with a group of rowdy friends in a restaurant until the owners called the police. Elizabeth was underage at the time, so she was booked and fingerprinted, but never really charged. The police officer felt sorry for her and arranged for Elizabeth to be sent back to Massachusetts. It was not long before Elizabeth returned to California, this time to Hollywood. In Los Angeles, Elizabeth met a pilot named Lieutenant Gordon Fickling and fell in love. He was the type of man she had been searching for and quickly made plans to marry him. However, her plans were halted when Fickling was shipped out to Europe. Elizabeth took a few modeling jobs, but still felt discouraged with her career. She went back to East to spend holidays in Medford before living with relatives in Miami. She began dating servicemen, marriage still on her mind, and again fell in love with a pilot, this time named Major Matt Gordon. He promised to marry her after he was sent to India. However, Gordon was killed in action, leaving Elizabeth heartbroken once again. Elizabeth had a period of mourning where she told others that Matt had actually been her husband and that their baby had died in childbirth. Once she began to recover, she attempted to return to her old life by contacting her Hollywood friends. One of those friends was Gordon Fickling, her former boyfriend. Seeing him as a possible replacement for Matt Gordon, she began to write to him and met with him in Chicago when he was in town for a few days. She was soon falling head over heels for him again. Elizabeth agreed to join him in Long Beach before she moved back to California to continue pursuing her dream of being in the movies. Elizabeth left LA on December 8, 1946 to take a bus to San Diego. She was supposed to take a bus to San Diego, but before she left, Elizabeth had been staying with Mark Hansen, who said that Elizabeth had supposedly been worried about something. While Elizabeth was in San Diego, she befriended a young woman named Dorothy French. Dorothy was a country girl at Aztec Theater and had found Elizabeth sleeping in one of the seats after an evening show. Elizabeth told Dorothy that she left Hollywood because finding a job as an actress was difficult with the actor strikes that were going on at the time. Dorothy felt sorry for her and offered her a place to stay at her mother's home for a few days. In reality, Elizabeth ended up sleeping there for over a month. Elizabeth did little housework for the French family and continued her late-night partying and dating habits. One of the men she became enamored with was Robert Red Manley, a salesman from Los Angeles who had a pregnant wife at home. Manley admitted that he was attracted to Elizabeth, yet claimed that he never slept with her. The two of them saw each other on and off for a few weeks, and Elizabeth asked him for a ride back to Hollywood. Manley agreed and picked her up from the French household on January 8, 1947. He paid for a hotel room for that night and went to a party with her. When the two of them returned to the hotel, he slept on the bed and Elizabeth slept in a chair. Manley had an appointment in the morning of January 9th and returned to the hotel to pick Elizabeth up around noon. She told him that she was returning to Massachusetts, but first needed to meet her married sister at the Biltmore Hotel in Hollywood. Manley drove her there, yet did not stick around. He had an appointment at 6:30 p.m. and did not wait for Elizabeth's sister to arrive. When Manley saw Elizabeth last, she was making phone calls in the hotel lobby. Manley and the hotel employees were the last people to Elizabeth Short alive. As far as LAPD could tell, only Elizabeth's killer saw her after January 9, 1947. She was missing for 6 days from the Biltmore Hotel before her body was found in a vacant lot on the morning of January 15, 1947. There have been many Black Dahlia suspects or persons of interest. As I said, they have been proposed as the unidentified killer of Elizabeth Short, nicknamed the Black Dahlia, who was murdered in 1947. Many conspiracy theories have been advanced, but none have been found to be completely persuasive by experts, and some are not taken seriously at all. The murder investigation was mainly led by the LAPD, and it was the largest since the murder of Marion Parker in 1927, and involved hundreds of officers borrowed from other law enforcement agencies. Sensational and sometimes inaccurate press coverage, as well as the nature of the crime, focused intense public attention on the case. As the case continued to command public attention, many people have been proposed as Short's killer, much like London's Jack the Ripper murders. Because of the complexity of the case, the original investigators treated every person who knew Elizabeth Short as a suspect, who had to be eliminated. Hundreds of people were considered suspects and thousands were interviewed by the police. About 60 people confessed to the murder, mostly men, but including a few women. However, 24 people were considered to be viable suspects by the LA County District Attorney. So I will go with some of them who are the most likely ones, not all 24, but I'll try to go through as many of them as I can. While some of the original 24 suspects were discounted, new ones did arise with time. At present, the following suspects are discussed by various authors and experts. So we first have Walter Bailey. Bailey was a Los Angeles surgeon who lived one block south of the vacant lot in which Short's body was found, until he left his wife in October 1946. His daughter was a friend of Short's sister in Virginia and had been the matron of honor at her wedding. When Bailey died in January 1948, his autopsy showed that he was suffering from a degenerative brain disease. After his death, his widow alleged that his mistress knew a terrible secret about Bailey and was made the main beneficiary upon his death as a result. Bailey was never a suspect in the case, but many medical doctors and others with medical training were. In secret testimony, Detective Harry Hansen, one of the original investigators, told the 1949 Los Angeles County Grand Jury that, in his opinion, the killer was a top medical man and a fine surgeon. Bailey was 67 years old at the time of the murder and had no known history of violence or criminal activity of any kind, and is not known to have met Short, even through his daughter, even though his daughter was a friend of Short's older sister. When Larry Harnish, a Los Angeles Times copy editor and writer, began studying the case in 1996, he eventually concluded that Bailey could be Short's killer. Although critics of Harnish's theory questioned whether Bailey's mental and physical condition at the time of the murder would have been consistent with the commission of this type of crime, the original investigator's theory that the body was cut in half because the killer wasn't strong enough to move it intact partially answered this objection. Harnish theorizes that Bailey's neurological deterioration contributed to his alleged violence against Short. Some have suggested that the secret Bailey's mistress was blackmailing him with was that he had performed abortions, then a crime. However, there is no evidence that either Bailey or his associates performed any abortions. Author James Ellroy endorsed Harnish's theory in the 2000 film James Ellroy's Feast of Death. Among Harnish's psychological and behavioral evidence, Bailey's neurodegenerative condition was known to produce violent behavior in otherwise passive individuals. His surgical specializations included mastectomies, hysterectomies, and surgical removal of fat. In conversion with Bailey's former receptionists, Harnish discovered that he and his mistress would at dinner time watch movies of surgeries and autopsies. In devising his theory, Harnish consulted retired FBI profiler John E. Douglas, who advised that the very public location of the dump site was significant, since the killer had the ability to transport the body to a more remote site where it might not have been discovered. The site was one block away from property owned by Bailey's estranged wife, Ruth. Douglas also devised that the facial lacerations indicated personal anger towards the victim. Short would often falsely tell men that she had a son who had died tragically. Bailey did, in fact, have a son who was struck by a car and killed at the age 11. The deceased child's birthday was January 13. Short's body was discovered on January 15. The second newly found person of interest is Norman Chandler. Donald Wolfe's 2005 book, The Black Dahlia Files, The Mob, The Mogul, and the Murder That Transfixed Los Angeles, names Norman Chandler the publisher of the Los Angeles Times from 1945 to 1960 as a suspect in the murder. In a complicated scenario involving multiple perpetrators, Wolfe claims that Chandler impregnated Short while she was working as a call girl for the notorious Hollywood Madame Brenda Allen, which led to her murder at the hands of gangster Bugsy Siegel. Wolfe's claim that Short was a prostitute is at odds with the Los Angeles County District Attorney's files, which plainly state that she was not, as Wolfe asserts, pregnant. Lizzie Dillon. Dillon was a 27-year-old bellhop, aspiring writer, and former mortician's assistant who became a suspect when he began writing to Los Angeles Police Department psychiatrist Dr. G. Paul DeRiver in October 1948. Dillon was living in Florida at the time of his correspondence with DeRiver, but had formerly lived in Los Angeles. He read a story about the case in a True Detective Style magazine, which DeRiver was quoted and wrote to DeRiver regarding his theories on the case. In his correspondence, he mentioned an intense interest in sadism and sexual violence in hopes of authoring a book on the subject. Dillon offered up one of his friends, Jeff Connors, as a likely suspect over the course of their correspondence. DeRiver began to believe that Connors did not exist and that Dillon had committed the murder himself. In October 1948, Dylan agreed to meet with the river and was given the choice of one of the three states, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Arizona, or Las Vegas, Nevada. Dylan expressed reservations about Los Angeles and chose Las Vegas instead. The river and undercover LAPD officers met Dylan in Las Vegas for a couple of days and then proceeded to drive back to California. Once there, Dylan and the river traveled to San Francisco to unsuccessfully look for Connors. When Dylan offered up intimate details about the crime, he was taken into custody by the undercover officers and transported to LA. After this happened, Dylan sailed a postcard out a hotel window with a plea for help on it. It was discovered by a passerby and turned in to the local authorities. Police soon discovered that Connors did indeed exist. His real name was R.T. Lane. Lane had lived in Los Angeles at the time of the murder and was employed by Columbia Studios, a favorite hangout of Shorts, as a maintenance man. However, contrary to popular belief, Dylan could not be conclusively placed in San Francisco at the time of the murder. In fact, police never could account for Dylan's whereabouts between January 9 and January 15 during the time of the murders. Another likely suspect was John A. Dumas. Dumas, a 29-year-old soldier stationed at Fort Dix, New Jersey, confessed to Short's murder a few weeks after it occurred. Although this breakthrough was quickly dismissed by the original investigators, the LA press covered it enthusiastically until it was revealed that Dumas had been at Fort Dix at the time of the murder. Dumas was cleared of any involvement in crime, although he continued to claim he killed Short each time he was arrested for various offenses. Mark Hansen. Hansen was a Hollywood nightclub owner at whose home Short lived, either as a paying boarder or as a guest, on several occasions between May 1946 and October 46. Hansen's girlfriend Anne Todd shared a room with Short in this house, which was near Hansen's nightclub. Short called Hansen from San Diego on January 8th, making him one of the last people known to have spoken to her. The Los Angeles County District Attorney's files indicate that Hansen made contradictory statements to authorities about the nature of this conversation. An address book embossed with Hansen's name was among Short's belongings, mailed to the Los Angeles Examiner after her murder by someone claiming to be the killer. The address book belonged to Hansen, but he had never used it. Short had been using it as her own. The DA's files also indicate that Hansen had tried to seduce Short, but was rebuffed. He was one of the first serious suspects in the case, and he was still a prime suspect as late as 1951. Hansen was also linked to three other suspects, each of whom was a medical doctor. Buzz Williams, a retired detective with the Long Beach Police Department, wrote an article for the LBPD newsletter, The Rap Sheet in 2000, on Elizabeth Short's murder. Williams' father, Richard F. Williams, and his friend Colin Keller were both members of LA's gangster squad investigating the case. Keller believed Mark Hansen was the killer and said Hansen was Swedish and had spent some time at Sweden's medical surgical school, which would explain the precise dissection of Short's body. Keller also said that Hansen held elaborate parties at his Hollywood boarding house, and members of LAPD, along with the chief of detectives, Thad Brown and his brother Finnis Brown, attended, and later aided Hansen in a cover-up. Williams mentioned that Hansen owned a Ford Lincoln Mercury car lot on Hollywood Boulevard, and his LAPD friends were later coincidentally driving around town in brand new Lincoln cars. Hansen died of natural causes in 1964. No charges were ever brought against him. He had no criminal record and no known history of violence. LAPD Police Chief William Wharton told the LA Examiner that there was absolutely no case against Hansen. Hansen's great-granddaughter, Helen Alexis, you know, was interviewed for Puyi Twill's upcoming documentary on the Black Dahlia for NBC Peacock Productions. Popular accounts of the Black Dahlia case often portray Hansen as having connections to organized crime, but there is no evidence of this. George Hodel, Dr. George Hill Hodel Jr., came under police scrutiny in October 1949 when his 14-year-old daughter Tamar accused him of molesting her. Despite three witnesses testifying that they had seen Hodel having sex with Tamar, he was acquitted in December 1949. The trial led the LAPD to include Hodel, a physician specializing in sexually transmitted diseases, among its main suspects in the Dahlia case. Police put Hodel under surveillance from February 18 to March 27, 1950, to ascertain whether he could be implicated in the murder. In the surviving transcripts of the microphone recordings, Hodel was heard making highly incriminating statements. Things like, supposing I did kill Black Dahlia, they couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead. They thought there was something fishy anyway. Now they may have figured out, killed her. Maybe I did kill my secretary. The secretary referred to was Ruth Spaulding, who police had previously suspected of being murdered by Hodel in 1945. He was present when Spaulding overdosed and had burned some of her papers before police were called. The case was dropped owing to lack of evidence, but documents were later found that indicated Spaulding was about to publicly accuse Hodel of intentionally misdiagnosing patients and billing them for laboratory tests, medical treatment, and prescriptions not needed. Hodel's son, former LAPD police detective Steve Hodel, believes Short may have been one of his father's patients. In the final report to grand jury, dated February 20, 1951, Lieutenant Frank Jemison of the LA County DA's office wrote, "Dr. George Hodel, at the time of this murder, had a clinic at the East 1st Street near Alameda. Lillian Lanark, who lived with this doctor, said he spent some time around the Biltmore Hotel and identified the photo of victim Short as a photo of one of the doctor's girlfriends. Tamar Hodel's 15-year-old daughter stated that her mother, Dorothy Hodel, has told her that her father had been out all night on a party the night of the murder and said, 'They'll never be able to prove I did that murder.' Two microphones were placed in this suspect's home. Informant Lillian Lanark has been committed to the state mental institution at Camarillo. Joe Brett, a roommate at Hodel residence, cooperated as an informant. A photograph of the suspect in nude with a nude identified colored model was secured from his personal effects." He pretty much explained very much a lot of discriminating evidence against Hodel. However, despite all of this, he was still not found as guilty. Then we have George Knowlton. Little reliable information is available on George Knowlton, except that he lived in LA area at the time of the Black Dahlia murder and died in an automobile accident in 1962. In the early 1990s, George Knowlton's daughter Janice began claiming that she had witnessed her father murdering Elizabeth Short, a claim she based largely on recovered memories that surfaced during therapy for depression after a hysterectomy. Based on these recovered memories, Knowlton published that he was the Black Dahlia killer with veteran crime writer Michael Newton in 1995. In the book, Knowlton, a former professional singer and owner of a public relations company, alleged that her father had been having an affair with Elizabeth Short and that Short was staying in a makeshift bedroom in their garage. When she suffered a miscarriage, George Knowlton allegedly murdered Short in the garage and bisected her in the sink, then forced his, back at the time 10-year-old daughter Janice, to accompany him when he disposed of the body. According to Novelton, Short was a sex worker and a procurer of children for a child trafficking ring. Knowlton claimed that a former member of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department told her that her father was considered a suspect in the case by that agency, but this claim is unsupported by the public documents that have been released in the case. She claimed the same source told her that future LAPD chief and California politician Ed Davis and Los Angeles County District Attorney Brown Fitz were suspects in the murder as well. However, the evidence against him wasn't really incriminating, to say the least. It had a lot of conspiracy theories in different parts of it as well, and thus it was debated a lot as well. Then we have Robert M. Red Manley, the last person seen with Elizabeth Short before her disappearance. Manley was the LAPD's top suspect in the first few days after the killing. After two polygraph tests and a sworn alibi, Manley was set free. He also identified Short's handbag purse and one of her shoes after they were discovered in a trash can on January 25, 1947, several miles from the murder scene. Manley, who had been discharged from the army for mental disability, subsequently suffered a series of nervous breakdowns and claimed to be hearing voices. As a result, he was committed to Patton State Hospital by his wife in 1954. He died on January 16, 1986. The coroner contributed his death to an accidental fall. And lastly, we have our last suspect that I'm going to be covering in this episode, Patrick S. Orelli. According to Los Angeles District Attorney files, Dr. Patrick Orelli was a medical doctor who knew Short through nightclub owner Mark Hansen. According to the files, at the time of the murder, Orelli was a good friend of Hansen and frequented Hansen's nightclub. Files also state that Orelli attended sex parties at Malibu with Hansen. Orelli had a history of sexually motivated violent crime. He had been convicted of assault with a deadly weapon for taking his secretary to a motel and sadistically beating her almost to death, apparently for no other reason than to satisfy his sexual desires without intercourse, the files state. Further, the files indicate that Orelli's right pectoral had been surgically removed, which investigators found similar to the mutilation of Short's body. The files indicate that Orelli had once been married to the daughter of an LAPD captain. And that's the case and the suspects for today, guys. I really liked the Black Dahlia case, especially when it was discovered on American Horror Story. I was really obsessed with American Horror Story when I was in middle school. So when I first saw the Black Dahlia mentioned there, I started searching it up, and it was pretty much what got me into true crime. And I hope you guys liked my intake on this case. And again, I would like to apologize for mispronouncing any words or any names. I meant no disrespect to anyone or any language. I'm not a native English speaker, as you can tell. So there's bound to be some mistakes, to be honest. But I hope you guys liked it. And I guess I'll see you guys in the next episode.